You're listening to a program created at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Thank you for supporting our research in consciousness and its practical applications for education, healthcare, and a more sustainable world. For more information, visit us at www.noetic.org.
Welcome to the 15th teleseminar in our series, Exploring the Noetic Sciences. Tonight's program asks, can mediums talk to the dead? Can you? Why should we care? And we are delighted to have our special guest, Dr. Julie Beischel. But right now, I will turn things over to our host, IONS Senior Scientist, Dean Radin.
Thank you very much. Julie is an unusual person in that she has a mainstream education. Her background includes a doctorate in pharmacology and toxicology with a minor in microbiology and immunology, many ologies involved there, from the University of Arizona in 2003. And unlike many people who continue on in their chosen field, Julie did a dramatic turn into a field of which there are perhaps one or two other people in the world who are engaged in this topic. And I think it's fair to say that Julie has probably done more research on mediumship in particular than anyone else perhaps in the last 20 to 80 years. And in addition, it's not only that she's doing research in these topics, but that the nature of the research has really notched up what we have known before, using new techniques, a very sophisticated way of finding mediums who are good at what they do, and so on. I would recommend the Winbridge Institute's website, which is winbridge.org, which is Julie's institute, for it has a lot of information on it, but one in particular that's useful for people who don't know much about mediumship is a video that was part of a talk that she gave at the Society for Scientific Exploration last year. It's about a 40-minute video, and it's a very, very good introduction to modern mediumship. So I think that's enough of an introduction, and so welcome, Julie.
Thank you so much for having me. I didn't know I was capable of all those things. And
you see,
wow.
This is why it's always good to get somebody else to introduce you, because then you don't have to
be
humble.
I will have you write my resumes from now on.
I'd be happy to. So I know that we both give many talks, and so we're already able to anticipate what most people are interested in asking. So I will ask you the first question that you likely get a lot, which is how did a nice young lady with a PhD in toxicology and pharmacology end up doing mediumship research?
That's a very good question, and I do get asked that a lot. Kind of a long story, but the short version is when I was in graduate school, I don't want to bring the mood down, but my mom committed suicide, and I would say science is my religion, so I didn't have any answers. I was 24 at the time. I didn't have any answers about what the afterlife was like or if there was an afterlife, so I turned to science. Science is my religion. And I turned to science to see what science had to say about the afterlife. And though there were some things being done, you know, we did not have very many answers. And in my investigation of, you know, what we knew, and I had a reading from a medium. And from my personal experience, I recognized that there was clearly something going on there. And I have a very strong sense of justice, so it angered me incredibly to know that there were these people in the world, and I'm not saying all of them, but there are people in the world who have this sort of innate gift of what they experience as communication from the other side, and they just want to use it to help people. And I felt a lot of anger around the fact that people were just dismissing the whole thing outright without any information about the reality of it. So I got on my soapbox, and I began to pursue it as a scientific investigative pursuit.
And so I take it that...
That brings us to today.
Yes, but there, but I think you did it in a somewhat different way than others may have. Because a lot of scientists are interested in these kinds of questions. In fact, a lot of people are interested in questions about survival. But they don't take the time and the care to study the data long enough to be able to tweak their prior belief. So, as you said, if science is your religion, at least within the Western science tradition, when you're dead, you're dead. That's the end of it, because the brain is the mind, and that's the end of the story. So you must have had a lot of motivation to push through that argument, which is what most college students get by the time they finish, certainly by the time they finish a PhD. Was there anything other than the, I mean, once you had the mediumship experience, that probably pushed you a lot, but what about the nature of the literature that you read afterwards?
I think one of the things that helped was because my degree is in the medical field and biology, we didn't care about consciousness, so it really never came up what happened when you died. So I didn't have any preconceived notions. I was never taught that the brain created the mind, so it didn't take a lot for me to get over that because before my mom died, I didn't even know what a medium was. So I didn't have a lot of preconceived notions that I had to get past. I was a blank slate. And so that first experience, and, you know, a personal experience is the most moving. People can look at our data and our p-values till the end of time, but they have one reading, you know, that makes all the difference. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what happened. Was just
right.
That. I didn't have a lot to get over. I didn't have to change my mind much because I didn't have any set beliefs about consciousness. And two, I had this personal experience that was, you know, demonstrating that there was something going on here that required further investigation. And like you said, not a lot of people doing it. So
right.
It was up
right.
to me sort of thing.
So here's a question that just popped into my head. As a biologist, you have probably been around lots of studies involving mice and other animals. And so given your perspective now, do you imagine that when the mice are euthanized after doing whatever experiment they've done, do they continue on in mouse heaven somewhere? Or are there little departed mice out there?
I hope so. I think the example we can... most people can relate to is with companion animals or pets, and you spend enough time with your, you know, I know my dog. My dog has consciousness. I have no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. And then the question is, how far back in the evolutionary tree can you go where, you know, consciousness stops? Do amoeba have consciousness? You know, these are all questions that we don't have answers to now, but you know, animal consciousness is actually another topic that we're really interested in at Winbridge. My husband, the co-founder of Winbridge, Mark Bacuzzi, did a presentation at the recent Florida Science of Consciousness conference on a study that we did with our dog and a random event generator. And
why don't you describe that?
An interest of ours too. What's that?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm familiar with that study, and it was interesting. So it's not exactly in the mediumship realm, but it does relate to the idea of where does consciousness begin and end. And as you're right, that my suspicion is it doesn't end. It's everywhere all the time. And if that's the case, then the idea that we are momentarily embodied with consciousness, but we might be saturated with it. Everywhere. We're just not normally aware of it. Maybe mediums are aware of
it. Right.
But take a few minutes and describe your experiment with Moose, the dog.
With Moose. So it's kind of complicated, but there's a company called Cyleron, and they make random event generators, and they offer an online service called SyncText, where you can get an account, and you are assigned a stream from a random event generator at the Cyleron facilities. And you load your account with a number of messages, And whenever that stream from that random event generator goes non-random, it text messages you one of your messages. It randomly chooses one. So we set up Moose with an account, and she had her own email address, moose@wimbridge.org, and her messages were seven messages and in increasing orders of activity. So one said, I am sleeping, two said, I am dreaming, up to seven, I am running around like a crazy. And we had five video cameras in our house, and 24 hours a day, the places where Moose was most likely to be were being videotaped. And at the end of every day, we check to see at what time a sync text message came in, and we didn't look at the message. It will also email it to you, so we opted for the email version. And we looked at the times that the messages came in, and then we coded the video for what she was doing at that time. And then we did a correlation between if the sync text matched what she was doing on the video, and it turned out it did. It's a weekly statistically significant effect, but it was there nonetheless. Mm-hmm. So there's a bunch of interesting interpretations that you can do. We did a second round where Mark and I each had a account. So and the seven things said Moose is sleeping, Moose is dreaming, and my account was very significant, and Mark's was not. His correlation didn't reach significance at all. And I spend all day every day with Moose, and I was there when she was born, and we are inseparable. And so at any given time, I probably could guess what she was doing. And so that was an interesting find that, whatever it was, either, with other people who have written about animal psi, have theorized that it's not necessarily the psi of the animal or the psi of the person, but it's the combination of the two. It's the sort of the psi of the relationship. So that is what we saw.
I wonder if this is relevant then to the relationship between a person who's living and one who's departed, that the connection between oneself and one's departed loved one, I can see that there might be a link, but then how does a medium come into play? How do they that link?
Right. People say, because when we do our quintuple blind experiments, there's mm-hmm. five levels of blinding, the medium and I are on the telephone, and all we have is the first name of a deceased person. That's all the information we have. We're both blinded. So I give the medium the first name, Jack, and then I ask a number of specific questions about Jack, and people say, how does she know how to find the right Jack? It's not up to her. Jack finds her. So most mediums will experience communication before the reading even starts. So before I even call, Jack is already there trying to, tell her messages he wants to get through, or provide identifying information or that sort of thing. So it's not a, she is literally a channel. It's not up to her. She just reports what shows up.
How does Jack know that Jack is going to be the person?
That is a good question.
What's your guess?
That is a very good question. I think it's just, once you are not bodily bound and you have access to all this non-local information, then they know. They know in my planner what medium's name is in my planner with next to their name, and they can find her. And there was a – I recently started a blog to I think it's – people could go on the Winbridge site to find it because I never – I think it's drjuliebeischel.blogspot.com. But I post – behind-the-scenes things that don't end up in journal articles but are interesting and perhaps evidential. And recently, we were doing a lot of readings. We're testing a bunch of new mediums. We're collecting data for a study. So my planner is full of deceased people's names and mediums' names. And it turned out, because everything is randomized, that two deceased people with the same name, the name I use in the, the names of the privacy of the deceased will be protected, so I use the name Sally. So two deceased people named Sally were supposed to be read on the same day. And I sort of just held my planner up to the universe, like, you guys are going to have to figure this out because I don't know who goes with who. And I called up the first medium, and or maybe she had emailed me, and she was ill, so she couldn't do the reading. And then so we pushed it back a week. So then the other Sally got her own day. And then that first Sally, when I tried to call the medium the following week, her phone wouldn't work. So it was, I think, 3 weeks out from when it was supposed to be scheduled. So it didn't, you know, it all worked out, oddly enough. And they didn't get, there was no confusion because only one Sally got read on any given day. So they have a way to work it out there. There must be some sort of awesome receptionist, or I don't know, but someone's organizing something over there.
Let's back up a second and describe not the quintuple blindedness, because that makes your brain hurt, but describe more of a simple version of at least a double-blind mediumship experiment, the sort of classic thing that you've already done many times, just for the sake of the audience, for people to understand what does it mean to do a study involving mediums.
Right. So a single-blind mediumship reading would be where the medium was kept blinded to the information about the deceased person, any prior information. But the experimenter knew who the deceased person was, or they knew who the sitter was, or they had that sort of information. Once you blind the experimenter also, then it becomes double blind. So in those cases, like I said, I get on at a scheduled time, I call up a medium, and I have a first name of a deceased person. It does require more people it's hard to just be double, because how did I get the name? So there has to be someone else involved who's giving me the name that's blinded at, you know, some other part of the study. But so the medium and I just have this first name of the deceased person. So I call them up and I say the person's name is Jack, and then we ask four questions about Jack when he was alive. So we say, we ask, what did Jack look like when he was alive? Describe his physical appearance, describe his personality, describe his hobbies or activities or what he liked to do, how he spent his time, and then cause of death. And if you have that information about any given person, you can pretty much determine if it's the person you're looking to hear from. So then once that's sort of established, then we ask, does Jack have any comments, questions, requests, or messages for the sitter? Because we've asked him to jump through all our science hoops. The least he should be able to do is, you know, what he came for, which is to provide information for the living person, who we call the sitter who is interested in hearing from him. And then the last question is just, is there anything else you could tell me about this person? So that just gives the medium sort of a open space to just whatever else she's getting from Jack. And then the other...
So you record...
Again,
I presume you record.
We audio record.
Yeah,
we audio record that phone call, and it does get complicated with the definitions of blinding, because you also could think of it: the medium is blinded and the sitter is blinded. So it's just me and the medium on the phone. So the sitter doesn't hear the reading. The living person who wants to hear from Jack, they didn't hear that reading. So then the medium and I do that whole process a second time on a different day with a different deceased person. So let's say Bob. So we ask the same questions about Bob. And then that is also audio recorded. And then I take those recordings and I turn them into itemized lists so that each numbered item is a single piece of information. He had brown hair. He had blue eyes, whatever the different pieces of information are. And then those two lists are emailed to the two sitters, the people who lost Jack and Bob, but they don't know which one is which. The readings have been blinded. So then they score each reading as to how it applies to their deceased person. And then they pick which one they think belonged to them. And then we compare the scores that a person gave their own reading to the scores they gave the other person's reading without knowing which is which, and we look at that difference.
And what do the results of such experiments show?
they're pretty strongly significant. They can do it. So in a study we published some years ago, we did that 16 times, and 13 out of 16 people were able to choose their own reading from the two, and that's a significant result. And so we're currently replicating that published study with a much larger, that one was 16. We're trying to get to 32.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can show it.
How important is it that the medium is a medium? In other words, if there were something like a control medium, someone who didn't profess any ability to be able to do this, would they get chance results on that?
I would assume so, yeah. What we see is that when someone scores someone else's reading, they're usually about 20 to 25% correct. So about a quarter of the information that a medium provides might relate to someone else. And I don't think that says any – that's not a criticism of mediums or mediumship. It just goes to show you that that's how similar we are as people and that, there's going to be things that are going to be true for everybody sort of thing. And when we have a medium read two deceased people, a process has been completed where those two people are paired to be the most different. Mm-hmm. So that when a sitter receives two readings, they don't both describe, grandmotherly relationship and short and plump and she liked cooking and she died of, lung, whatever. It could, where you would have a really difficult time figuring out which one of them was your grandmother. So up front, we pair the deceased people to be the most different to optimize the ability to distinguish between the two. Otherwise, it's not telling at all. If you can't pick between the two because the two people are very similar, that doesn't test anything. So we pair the people ahead of time to optimize that process.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that I think is unique about Winbridge is the large number of mediums that have passed through a variety of hoops to make sure that they are actually as good as they think they are. And so could you describe this process of forming what you've called a research medium?
Yes. We have an 8-step process, and I should point out that recruitment is closed at this time. We're not looking for any new mediums. We have a bunch going through the 8 steps at this time. Currently 6 are on our website that have passed all 8 steps. And I won't go through it all, but it's a lot of tests and interviews and blinded readings. And then once a person passes, step 5 is the blinded readings part. If they pass that, then they go on and then they're trained. The medium is trained in grief and human subjects, laws and regulations. We found that about 25% of people who think that they're good enough to pass our stringent testing do no better than chance. So that's very interesting.
Does that mean that 75% actually do pass?
Yeah, that is a little surprising, but it's so daunting that only people really confident that they can do it even attempt to. And we're not for a medium to serve as a Winbridge certified research medium, they agree to volunteer 4 hours per month to research. So they're really part of the research team. So only people really interested in the scientific pursuit of this investigation and willing to sort of, dedicate part of their life to research even attempt the process.
That's still pretty impressive. I understand that it's a highly selected group, but for 75% of the applicants to have a very special talent like that is pretty impressive.
And I think that just goes to show it's not so miraculous. A lot of people can do it, and a lot of people can do it really well. So I think, you know, I've heard a number of mediums say they're not special, and they don't like to be called that, and it rubs them the wrong way when they hear other mediums, you know, on TV or whatever, talk about, you know, how special they are and how unique this is, because a lot of mediums will say their job is to put themselves out of business, because if one human brain can do this, then anybody can. And I think it's probably closer to, you know, in parapsychology, the word virtuoso is often used. Like, some people are just born with this, and they just can do it right off. And some people can practice and practice and never be as good as a virtuoso. There are probably tips, but a lot of memes will say you just have to be open. You have to just learn to let go of all the cognitive blocks that you've put on yourself and that other people have put on you, saying this isn't possible, you can't do this.
Well, yes and no. That's easier said than done. So I think there really are differences in native talent, and while being open is important, that alone is probably not sufficient. So I understand the humility that is underlying those comments, but there's something should be said also for the actual talent involved.
Yes, yes, definitely. And there are a lot of, I attended the International Association for Near-Death Studies meeting last year, and the topic was how a near-death experience will sort of bring about psychic abilities in people who have NDEs. And that's... we have heard that a number of times, that I think sort of one of the sort of textbook experiences is that a person will have the experiences when they're young, from as long as they can remember, and then as they reach adolescence, they realize not everyone could do this, and they better not talk about it, and, you know, because teenagers just want to be like everybody else. So they sort of shut it off, and then something happens. And it doesn't have to be as dramatic as a near-death experience, but something happens to sort of kick it back into, to the front burner, and now they are experiencing it again. Mm-hmm. That's a common story that we hear.
So where do you see, given that you've been spending, the last 6 years or so, or 7 years doing mediumship research, published a number of really great papers, where do you see that this line of research can go in 5 to 10 years, say? Do you think, for example, it would be possible that the cumulative data would start actually persuading people, people who previously wouldn't have given you the time of day, that you would have enough data to be able to persuade them that there's something really, at minimum, something really interesting going on, and at maximum, that there really is survival.
Right. It's right in our name, we're the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research, so we want to know how this can benefit humanity. And in our mission statement is that best serves all living things. So I think we could gather data to no end. It still wouldn't convince some people. You know, I've had p-values and peer-reviewed journal articles, and still people go, oh, no, that's just a fluke. So there's a cognitive block that I'm not going to waste my time banging my head into the wall trying to convince people that just refuse to see that something's going on here. So we've gone down another path, and what can we do with this? How can this help? So we recently presented some pilot data that we had done about the potential therapeutic benefits of a mediumship reading. There's a lot of evidence that spontaneous or even induced after-death communication on a personal level has a great effect on grief. And we propose that a mediumship reading would be a really great prescribable treatment option for grief. There's recently a meta-analysis performed at the University of Memphis, where they demonstrated, I think it was 64 studies, traditional grief counseling wasn't benefiting the patients any better than the passage of time and the resources that the person already had, the support system they already had. So there's not an effective grief therapy out there. So there's a hole, and there's a need for this. And people who've had a mediumship reading report some really miraculous, instantaneous changes. And I think a lot of grief counselors would agree that to get past grief, you have to redefine your relationship with the person. And a mediumship reading really allow you to do that. And so we foresee a future where they work together, where someone can have a mediumship reading, and then they can take the information that the medium provided and bring it to a counselor to integrate that information into their lives. Because a medium is not, that's not what they do. And they're not, one of the other arms of research that we do is we study the medium's experiences. And we've demonstrated that they have an altered sense of time. They're not really present for the reading as it takes place. And you know, I know myself if I don't hear them say something, I'll say, oh, what did you say? And they don't even know what they just said because they're not, you know, I describe it as if you're on the phone with someone who's giving you a phone number and you're saying it out loud to a person in the room who's writing it down, as soon as you're done, you don't know what that phone number was. You were just saying it as the other person was saying it to you. And that's what a medium does. So they're not in a space that allows them to be a counselor too. That, you know, that's not what they're good at. And they shouldn't. They shouldn't have to be. But together, mediums and grief counselors could really make a difference in people's lives. And grief is really at the root of so many pathologies, addiction and, you know, all kinds of things. And I think there's really a need in the world for this. So that's where we're going. I just got back from the ICEM, the Subtle Energy Medicine Conference. Mm-hmm. And I was doing my spiel, and Charlie Tart was there. And I said, I foresee a future where your insurance company will pay for a mediumship reading. And he really laughed. And he said, I really had big dreams. But I don't think that's so crazy. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that your insurance company wouldn't pay for acupuncture. Now a lot of them do. I think I think this is the future that, you know, we just need to demonstrate its efficacy, and they're going to have to cave to public pressure. People are spending billions of dollars anyway. Let's make it, you know, let's certify people, and people can go to a reputable medium, and, you know, that's the future that I see.
That's a great future. And the beauty of it is that it finesses the scientific issue altogether. Because if you're saying it, in a sense it doesn't matter whether this is quote real or not real, what matters is that it has a significant impact on the thing of interest, in this case having to be resolution of grief.
Right.
But there
are lots of other things.
Yeah, I mean, but it also provides an opening. Obviously, the moment that something becomes covered by insurance, as an example, that really does finesse the issue of what's going on, but it makes people more open to the possibility that it might be real. And then the rest of the basic science can proceed apace.
Right. You know, and I want to make it clear that that's not the only question that we're chasing. We are doing basic research where we're, like I said, we were collecting data on a replication of a previously published study to demonstrate that this is indeed a real phenomenon. You know, and like I said, we're also looking at the medium's experiences, which helps us determine the source of the information. Like, mm-hmm. Are they talking to the dead? That's still a question. We still don't know the answer to that question.
Have you done a study with multiple mediums reading the same person to see if the yield, the information yield, might be better than just one medium?
No, because that is not how it works in nature.
Right.
And that makes a lot of assumptions. You know, maybe that would tire the deceased person. Maybe they don't want to talk to every medium on the block, so they just come the first time and they say their piece and then they go back to what they were doing, because from what the mediums say, you are busy, that you're not just sitting there on the other side waiting for a medium to hear you. You know, there's still, it's a learning process, and you're still growing. And so if we did that, if we had a number of meetings read the same person and it didn't pan out, you couldn't say it wasn't because the person just didn't show up for the second reading.
Right. No,
and
but
we did, there was...
But that's okay. That I'm thinking not so much of parallel or readings in sequence, but rather a parallel, like six mediums simultaneously hoping to speak to the same person. And the reason is not so much that you might get more information or better information, but it would be able to address the issue of what is it that is being communicated with. So
would that show if they couldn't do it? Or what would it show if they could?
If they couldn't, it wouldn't show anything. But if they could, if two or more mediums were able to simultaneously talk to what they perceive as the same person, and of course they'd all be doing this independently, that might be able to tell us something about what it is that they're communicating with. Because we certainly can't communicate simultaneously with six different people, but maybe a departed whatever could.
Yeah. I'll put it on the list of the very, very, very long list of interesting studies that we will do when we have the resources to do them. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first question I hear is, how did you get into this with a degree in pharmacology? Mm-hmm. And the second question is, oh, have you thought about doing so-and-so? Mm-hmm. And, of course, we have. but we just don't, it's just Mark and I. And we have some part-time research assistant and research colleagues. But I'm the only one on the Winbridge team that does Winbridge full-time. And so, as is the history of parapsychological research, not a lot gets done because you don't have the same, a university professor has lots of students and research assistants to be able to get things done quickly, but I can only get done what I can get done.
Mm-hmm.
So we're a little bit slower than we'd like. But that's really interesting, and I will add it to the list, Dean. I definitely will.
Good. Yeah, this issue about it's partially bandwidth and also resources. That you would think, I would think, that this topic would be of such great interest to so many people that funding would not be an issue. But, of course, the exact opposite. Yeah, it's really, mm-hmm. It's very strange that it's the opposite, that the research question seems to be the last thing on people's minds when, in a sense, it really should be the first.
Yeah, recently...
Go ahead.
I was recently... invited to be a featured blogger on the Daily Grail site, and I wrote a blog, and the title said, what affects more and is valued less? Nothing. Like, there's no topic that affects more people than what happens when we die. But it's mm-hmm. the least funded topic of any scientific inquiry.
That's very strange.
What is up with that?
Yeah, that deserves some research all by itself.
But
since we don't have time to do that research at the moment, we do have time, about 20 mm-hmm. minutes, for our listening audience to ask some questions. So I'll turn it back to Jeffrey and hear what people have to say.
Apologies again for my buzzy phone line. But if you have a question or a comment for Dr. Beisel, just press 1 on your phone, and I'll bring you the virtual mic. Okay, bring the mic over to Vicki.
Hi there. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Hi, Vicki.
Okay. First of all, as far as the research goes, I think maybe people just don't want to know. They're afraid to know,
I think you're right.
Yeah, I really think that's part of it. They have the fear. But my question is, have you ever considered during your testing that perhaps the medium is somehow tapping into a sitter's subconscious, not necessarily reaching someone else, but they're getting the sitter's information from them?
Yeah,
I don't want that to be the answer, personally, but I, it's just one of the things I've considered.
there's an animal behaviorist named Patricia McConnell, and she's talking about animal consciousness, but she, I think it's applicable to survival research too, and she says, just because an explanation makes us feel good doesn't mean it's not true. So, right. You know, just because that's the way that you want it to be doesn't mean that it can't, that can't be the way it is. But the, so even if we collected what's called proof-focused data to the end of time, if we showed that mediums could report accurate and specific information under blinding conditions, we still couldn't say where the information was coming from. So
right.
The alternative explanations are psi, that the medium is reading the mind of the sitter, that they're using remote viewing to, you know, peek into your grandma's photo albums, that they're looking into the future moment when they receive feedback from the reading. So you can't get over those things, and people say, oh, well, what if you ask for information that the sitter didn't know and then they could verify later? Well, then that's just precognition. It's still, like, almost anything that you can say, it still could just be psi, and that's why that theory is called super psi, because it's so extensive. So what we have an arm of research that's process-focused, so we look at the medium's experience, because as part of the services that they provide clients, they also do psychic readings for living people, and in a number of studies that we looked at, they claim and can distinguish between what it's like to receive psychic information and what it's like to communicate with a deceased person. So from the medium's perspective, of course they're not using psychic abilities to get information from the deceased, and I understand the psychology issues that may be at play there, that it, you know, that benefits, that's to their benefit to experience those things as different. But so far, it looks like they're able to distinguish between the two. So we have a study planned, pending funding, to look at that under blinded conditions. So
okay,
I will get back to you on that.
Question that kind of relates to that is, have you ever done any of these studies with the well-known psychics, such as Lisa Williams, John Edwards? I know you mentioned something
about some of them. We concentrate specifically on the, not like a star medium, but the combination of the results from a pool of mediums. And like I said, the mediums that we work with are research mediums, so they're part of their mediumship persona in life is research. And so, yeah, that doesn't fit in if, you know, part of your mediumship persona is, I'm not dissing anyone, but if part of it is
a TV
show, you don't have time to be part of research if you need to spend time on a TV show. So,
Well, I thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for your questions.
And I can add to that we're sometimes asked if we study famous psychics. And for people who are celebrities at what they do, they have much more to lose than to gain by being involved in a research project. So oftentimes they don't volunteer, and we don't ask.
Right, right. Yeah, I would say the same is true for mediums.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, bringing the mic over to Sandy. Just want to mention we've got quite a few questions. I know Julie does need to go at the top of the hour, so just want to encourage folks to
Well,
get your questions.
I could be convinced to go a little over the hour.
Okay,
thanks.
You have the mic. Go ahead.
Thank you. Dr. Bachel, I was just wondering, are there specific types of people that tend to be mediums?
We've as part of the screening process, step two is the medium takes three psychology tests and personality tests. And so we're in the process of still screening, we're still collecting that data. But what we have so far, it looks like, to no surprise, mediums are really high in the personality characteristic openness to experiences. And they're usually low in neuroticism. And these are mediums who agree to be researched. So that right there could be why they score low in neuroticism, because they're already not neurotic people. That might have nothing to do with the fact that they're mediums. We also see, which is the case for, Dean, correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of psychics in general, is they score high on the Myers-Briggs intuition scale and feeling scale.
Yes. Yep.
Yeah. So we found from the data I've collected today, 85% of the mediums that we've looked at are both intuitive and feeling on the Myers-Briggs personality type test.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Same is true for psychics, also for artists, for creative people of a wide range that fall into that category.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and clergy, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Bringing the mic over to Linda.
Hi. My question is this. You were talking about having limited resources for research and such. Have you ever considered reaching out to people who have had sessions with maybe world-famous mediums who do have data already that's verifiable and you know, working with those people to kind of share their experiences with you without, you know, identifying who the mediums were or whatever, just to support some of that data? Because I've had some amazing readings with people that had accuracy levels in the 90 and, you know, 80% range.
The issue with that is one, and I, you know, no offense to your experience, but one person's story doesn't convince scientists.
No, but there's a lot of us.
But rarely are they, is it under controlled conditions? So a skeptic will still list all the things they always list and say, oh, it was just this. It was just cold reading. It was just, you know, pick your insert skeptical comment here.
Right.
So I'm interested in how your question was about resources. So how I don't understand how that relates.
Well, because I was just saying, because there's so much data out there that the sitters themselves have that, you know, is so verifiable to them. And it's like detailed level stuff that, you know, is in general. Substantiates what you're saying and what you're doing. I mean, I guess it would be difficult to assimilate.
To be clear, when we use the word, when parapsychologists use the word resources, they're talking about money.
Oh, I know.
We don't have a lack of data. We don't have a way to
people and
to perform studies because we have to pay our mortgages and eat.
General statement. When you were talking about grief therapy and what have you, you are right on point. You know, it does help. What it does, well, at least what it did for me, is it helps eliminate the fear part of the loss. It may not take away the loss, but it substantially reduces the fear. And when you lose your child, the fear is huge. So
right.
I think you're right on point with that. So.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, that's. I'm glad that spoke to you and that you feel that that's correct. Yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
I can compare myself to other parents who haven't been as fortunate as I have to have these experiences, and they have some very deep grief and coupled with some fear that causes them to not sleep. And just it's really difficult. I don't have to deal with the fear portion. That for me is settled. It's just
because of experiences with mediums.
Correct. And self-education through reading stuff. But it's you know, you still have the separation issues and the loss part that you're working on.
Yeah, right.
But the fear, and as a parent, I mean, the fear can leave you paralyzed.
Yeah,
so,
and it's fear of where the child is.
Absolutely.
Caring
you never
for the child.
Stop.
Yeah. Okay.
You never stop being their parent.
Right.
So you're right on point.
Right. Okay, great. Thank you so much for that input.
Welcome.
Mike, over to Susie.
Great. I am a medium, but I'm not as good as your mediums. The dead came to me, and I didn't want to talk to them. I'm a spiritual intuitive. I didn't want to talk to the dead. I didn't want to be involved. I had no idea how to do it. I was terrified. And so I've worked with that, but I'm still not really great. And any information you have that would help me get better, if that's possible, that would be lovely.
I couldn't provide that to you, but I know some of our Winbridge certified research mediums offer classes.
Really?
So if you go on our website, right on the front page, it says Meet the Research Mediums, and if you go on that page, it lists them all, and it has links out to their different websites. So you could look there. you know, I'm just a scientist. I don't, I have nothing to offer you in that respect. But these very, very talented, you know, I say there's, I make no bones about saying they're the best mediums in the world, because they do what they do repeatedly on command under ridiculously blinded conditions. So they may have some words of wisdom for you.
That would be great. Yeah, I'm not playing with it, and the less I think, the better I do.
Yeah, so that I would agree with that. Yeah, don't push it, and don't try and get out of your logical mind as much as you can.
Well, that's it. And the more I can do that, the better off I am. The less I look for something I can recognize, the better I am. But thank you for this. Thank you so much. This has been really interesting.
Oh, great. Thank you.
Bringing the mic over to Lance. Go ahead.
Oh, really? Am I on? Interesting. Yep. Hi, Julie. It's Lance Beam. How are you?
Hi, Lance. How are you? I'm good.
I'm very good. I'm glad to hear you are, too. I wanted to make a couple of comments. As I was listening, I thought it was just great. And as a parent who lost a handicapped child who had a medium come in while the child was on life support, I can say that the medium actually read my daughter rather than us. And I'm a scientist. I'm still working with it a little bit, and we're working in that issue of remote viewing, but I would say this. We had an experience here in the last 3 months where we were at a bookstore and some mediums were given readings. And so my wife went over and had a reading with one woman, and I took a reading with another one, and I gave them no information, nor did she. And at the same time, in different rooms, our daughter was talking to both mediums. And
okay,
they were
good.
Verifiable.
There's some data for Dean.
Yeah. So that to me was interesting. And also, I had the opportunity to talk to Tim von Lummel at that consciousness conference in Tucson, mm-hmm. and when I told him my story, he said, but of course, Lance, it makes perfect sense that your daughter could tell you all about her life because she wasn't restricted by the human brain. She was in that state of consciousness that we're aware of, that we connect to, like I do when I do remote viewing, or like a medium does when they do their mediumship.
Right.
So maybe
Lance, Mark and I were just talking about you and your daughter today, and I think another that's very odd, and we were, you know, the example of the comfort that you drew from a medium, and that's why this research is important. And I think another thing that people would really find interesting, your daughter, you said you lost a handicapped child. She couldn't speak in her life. Is that correct?
Right. She couldn't.
But a medium can hear from her.
Right, exactly. And she was just alive by her brain stem. She had been unconscious for she'd been without oxygen or heartbeat for almost 15 minutes before she was resuscitated. And so all of this, just in brief, it really is striking to me that some of the comments I heard I could relate to, particularly that I'm sure that the medium was reading my daughter. I'm sure that also my daughter made it clear that she had heard me listening to some sad music in my mind, and she described it, and then she decided what song instead she would like played at her memorial service, which was the theme song to Sesame Street.
That's great.
Yeah.
So, oh, that's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Lance. Thank you so much
You're welcome.
Sharing that.
Yeah, thank you guys very much.
No problem.
Mic over to Lucia. You're live. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a two-part question. Let me start with this. I believe that for instance, I'm going to use my relationship with my dad, that relationship had an energy or almost a form, an energy form.
Mm-hmm.
And when my dad passed away, I wondered if spooky action at a distance didn't have some part in that. And when I do readings for people, I have wondered if that didn't have a part in sometimes in what I was doing, because it's different. It isn't the same every time when I read someone. And so I wonder if I have someone sitting in front of me, and that person has had this energy form, this relationship with someone, and that person is now elsewhere. There isn't spooky action at a distance that I can pick up on in order to get to that person, rather than it being that maybe necessarily that person arrives, because the dead person, that the passed away person would just arrive and start talking to me. I mean, that may happen sometimes. But more often than not, a reading can go in that direction all of a sudden. And I'm wondering if that couldn't have something to do with it. And, my other part of the question is, in your experience with your research mediums, do you hear them talking about it being a different quality of connection according to how long the person has been gone?
I'll start with your second one first. It doesn't seem to be it doesn't seem to make any difference how long the person's been gone. We haven't looked at that specifically, but I have not noticed that plays a part in it.
I wouldn't show up in your research for you, but I'm wondering if the mediums had mentioned anything in their work with you about a difference in quality of connection, or a difference in how it feels to connect with someone who's just passed and someone who's maybe been gone 10, 20, 30 years.
We haven't asked them that specifically, so I couldn't answer that. And I think your other question, I think what you're asking is, could it just be you using some form of psi to get your information about the deceased person? And yeah, like I said, the data collected to date, we can't say that it's not that. But it's the experience of the mediums that sort of makes us lean away from that.
I'm wondering if that's kind of what makes the road go two ways. If the deceased person can come to the medium and talk to that person very clearly, like you're talking on the phone, a person can go to them. But I understand in your research you don't really prefer that, right?
I don't really know what you're asking.
Probably sound like I'm babbling. Sorry about that. I'm just saying that I think it's a two-way street, and it isn't like the gentleman that just spoke, Lance. He knew his daughter could be in more than one place at the same time. And I'm just,
yeah.
Anyway, I better just be quiet with the next person. I'm not being very clear. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I wanted to note that we are up against the top of the hour, so I want to check in with you, Julie, see if you're okay taking more questions or if we should wrap up.
Let's do this. I'll take three more.
Okay, three more. Bringing the mic over to Salmo Jack. You have the mic. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you for your scientific perspective on this research. My question to you was, what's the most interesting thing you've run across?
Oh, my gosh. What a question. I think early on we were doing some pilot work, and we asked four mediums consecutively to contact the same deceased person, and it was a teenage girl who had died suddenly. And in the first reading, the medium said, she's here, but there's a boy with her, and the boy is doing the talking. And, okay, and then we hadn't asked that, but that's how she was experiencing it. And then the second medium the boy was there, but she was talking. And then the third medium, the boy wasn't there anymore. So it appeared to be a learning process, or at least the comfort of the girl that she wasn't ready to talk to the medium. So that was really interesting. And, you know, we can't quantify that, and I can't put a p-value on that. But I thought that that was really interesting, because if the mediums were just using psi to get their information, then why didn't they all get that she was with a boy? And why did it increase? Why did her independence increase linearly with time with the mediums? I would say that was a pretty interesting thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The mic over to stand by. Rosemary. Rosemary, you're live. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering if you have ever considered any of the ITC devices, like Radio Sweep, that are designed to, their purpose is to facilitate like real-time EVP. And people who have the best results with them have natural mediumistic abilities. So I was wondering if there might be any area of interest in these developing technologies to augment human mediumship.
Yeah, our survival research, our life after death research, takes three forms. Mediumship is just one, and that's my specialty. And then my husband, Mark, the other two are with technology. Can technology be used to interact with and detect the deceased? And then he has over a decade of experience investigating allegedly haunted locations. So that's the other two ways that we look at it. And we just finished writing up a study that we performed using the software EVP Maker to look at real-time communication using EVP Maker. So you can look for that publication in the near future.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Rosemary. Last question, bringing the mic over to Dave. Dave, you're live. Go ahead.
Thank you. I told my wife just a second ago that I would be the last one. we're both mediums, and we've been, and talk about a stigma. We have been working with what we call a channel board, which is a glorified Ouija board, for the last several years. And we feel we've been getting very accurate information. In fact, accurate so much to the point that we've diagnosed and been a part of this entire economic debacle through the stock market and other things. And we've also done a lot of recordings, and we have EMF detectors when we're doing this channeling using the channel board. And I just wondered if you have done any work with anything like the Ouija or channel board.
That would be a question that Mark could answer, and I know that in our bag of tricks, we have a glow-in-the-dark Ouija board. I don't know if he's used it in scientific capacity, but I know we have one. And that I don't think there are any pieces of equipment that he wouldn't be willing to incorporate into his studies. So we are definitely, and he has all the EMF meters and all of that, all of those gadgets. So he's definitely looked at those things. Again, I can't really speak to what he found. We would need to ask him. But yeah, he's on it. I'll say that.
Okay, so I'd be happy to send you some information that we've accumulated as well. Then thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dave. So sorry to those of you whose questions we didn't get to, Julie. That means we'll just have to have you back really soon.
Okay.
Back over to Dean.
Well, I wanted to thank you, Julie, for participating in this teleconference, because, as I said, it is the best attended teleseminar that we've had so far, which, among other things, reflects the likelihood that this topic, the topic of survival and ways of doing research on it, is one of the hottest topics there are. And so, actually, I would like to bring you back as a as for another teleseminar. Exactly when we do that, I'm not sure, but I'd be glad to have you back again anytime.
I'd be happy to. Before we go, can I plug a couple things?
Oh, go ahead and plug.
Okay. So you mentioned our website is winbridge.org, so I invite people to go on there. On the site, if you go to the news page, you can join our email updates list so that I think that's one of the reasons why we have so many listeners today is because we sent out an email this morning. And so people, if they join our email list, they're updated about things like this. On our site, people can become a member if they're interested in receiving our – we have a quarterly newsletter that the issue comes out tomorrow. And we have recommended books and DVDs from our investigators and our advisory board. And I mentioned my research blog, drjuliebeischel.blogspot.com. You can also buy great gifts and gear. I at the meeting when I did my we had a poster and I did a poster presentation. I wore a T-shirt that said "Ghosts are people too." So we sell kitschy things like that at our store at cafepress.com/winbridge. And then people can become a fan of the Winbridge Institute on Facebook. And starting next week, we're going to have some Facebook events on our Facebook page. So people can go to facebook.com/winbridge.institute.
What is the Facebook event?
I,
no, that's a very good. Those are good talks, but what is the Facebook event?
Yeah. We're gonna have a weekly. It's called 2 Cents Tuesdays, and so every Tuesday I will post a question, and then people can put in their 2 cents about whatever question is posted.
Excellent.
So it's like a discussion, a Facebook discussion. Yeah.
Right. That's a good idea. Well, so thank you once again, Julie.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank
so
you
much.
So much for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this program from IONS. Located in Petaluma, California, the Institute of Noetic Sciences is a nonprofit membership organization that conducts scientific research into the potentials and powers of consciousness. To learn more about IONS, please visit us at www.noetic.org or call toll-free 877-769-4667.